Hello, and welcome to New Books in African American Studies, the interview series where writers of African American arts, culture, life, and sciences discuss their new books. I'm your host, Vershawn Young, and today I'll be speaking with Curtis L. Chrysler about two of his books of poems. The first, Tough Boy Sonatas, published by Front Street Press in 2007, which is also beautifully illustrated by Floyd Cooper. This book of poems is about what Curtis calls urban Midwestern life. It pictures Gary, Indiana, and the surrounding Midwestern region. His second book that we'll be talking about is Pulling Scabs, published by Aquarius Press in 2009. In our lively exchange, Curtis reveals a lot about his Midwestern background and the influences that brings his work to life. Please listen in. Hello, Curtis.
Hey, Dr. Vay, what's up?
Not much. Today, we're speaking with Curtis L. Chrysler. He's an assistant professor of English at Indiana University, Purdue University, Fort Wayne. On his website, which I invite all of our listeners to visit, he says he is interested in his Midwestern roots and how the diversity of history makes up all that is America. And we see this impulse in his many books. He has three books of poetry, Pulling Scabs, which was published in 2009 by Willow Books, the one that we'll be discussing today. This book was also nominated for the esteemed Pushcart Award. He's published Tough Boy Sonatas, published by Word Song, and he has a young adult novel to his credit called Dreamist. It's a mixed genre novel also from Willow Books. Curtis also has a chapbook entitled Spill, which was published in 2008. And it won the Keyhole Chapbook Award at Keyhole Press. He has also edited a collection of nonfiction entitled Leaving Me Behind, Writing a New Me. And you can find that at lulu.com. We're happy to have Curtis on the show today. So, Curtis, can you begin by telling us a little bit about yourself and perhaps a little bit about these works that I've just enumerated?
Okay. Well, originally I'm from Gary, Indiana. If you read Tough Boy Sonatas, you'll see the influence there and how Gary has affected me. And so my background comes from that. Fourth grade, I tracked back my first aspect of writing to the fourth grade when my mother helped me with a Jackie Robinson poem for Black History Month. And from that point, I had been writing here and there, you know, kind of trying to impress girls here and there, which didn't work. but after high school, I started keeping collections and stuff like that. And then after I went to ITT in Fort Wayne, where I'm at, where I currently reside, after I set out for like 4 or 5 years, I went back to school for writing. I started in journalism. Then I saw how they cut up everything. So I ended up going into poetry, and that's where things started happening for me. And so in the 90s, I wanted to publish, and I was starting to read more of, you know, Black arts writers, Harlem Renaissance, the Beats, surrealism from the French perspective, and from the Latin perspective, things like that. And so from that point on, I was just, hey, I need to be a writer and I need to get this stuff out. And so I went to, I got my BA at ITFW. I left and went to SIUC, Southern Illinois University in Carbondale. And I had a great staff there. And that's where Crab Orchard Review is as well. Allison Joseph, Rodney Jones. Great, you know, a great place for writing. Adrian Matichka, I met there. I met a lot of friends there. My friend Kevin McKelvey, who are all writers as well. And that's where I started into getting into Kavi Kainum. And after that, it just kind of blew up for me.
Wow.
And then I came back to Fort Wayne and limited term lecturer. Visiting, limited term lecturer, visiting, then they put me on tenure track. So here I am.
Well, they recognize what a lot of your readers recognize, that you're extremely, extremely talented. I wanted to tell you something. I went to SIU Edwardsville.
Oh, okay. All right. When were you there?
I can't tell the dates.
Oh, okay. All right. But did you graduate from there? Or that's your alma mater? Okay,
It's my undergraduate alma mater. Mm-hmm. They said that SIU Edwardsville was the studious school, and you went to the party school, Carbondale.
Yeah, I've heard that too, yeah. As a matter of fact, it's funny you mentioned that. I remember my first year there, we had a whole week off for Halloween because something had happened the Halloween before, and so they didn't want the actions to happen again. So they gave us a whole week off and shut down everything for the most part.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, now you have published what seems like a book a year since 2007.
Yeah. I was looking at that and I missed 2010, but in 2009, I did have two books published. So I kind of can push. I feel I can push one to 2010. But yeah, I've been really blessed in that.
So the main part of our discussion today will be about your latest collection of poetry, Pulling Scabs. Mm-hmm. But I would like for you to talk a little bit about Tough Boy Sonatas. And the reason being is because I use this book in my classes quite a bit. I teach sometimes Midwestern literature. Uh-huh. And the fact that is about Gary, Indiana, and also peeking over into Chicago, and its industrial landscape that you capture in this book, I think it's really well done. The other thing about it is that unlike the other books of yours that I have, this book is illustrated, and the illustrations are wonderful. The cover art itself by Floyd Cooper is just it's exquisite. So I mean this mixed art form, this the art and the poetry together works so well. Can you talk to us about Tough Boy Sonatas and possibly read a selection from it?
Okay. Well, first I'd like to say that this is my thesis. And I remember Rodney Jones being on my panel. He said, whoever publishes this is going to have balls. And I was like, wow, now it's never going to get published, Rodney. And Willow Books is a young adult genre, which I was kind of worried about. But having a workshop with Marilyn Nelson, she said, we need more African-American writers, especially males, in the aspect of this genre. And so I said, well, I have a manuscript that plays to the thematic aspect of boys and youth, but I'm not sure, you know, how it go over. Gave it to her. She read some poems. Later that night, she said she was going to show these poems to Stephen Roxburgh, who at the time was working for Willow Books. And he texted me and contacted me and said he read the 10 poems and could I send the whole manuscript. I sent the whole manuscript, and the next day he got to me and said, well, what do you want to do? And I was like, what do you mean? He said, do you want to publish this? And I was like, you read the whole manuscript? You know, being a writer, that never happens. And so he had read the whole manuscript. He wanted to publish it as a young adult book, and I was kind of worried about like the pictures you were talking about, but in seeing Marilyn's Carver, A Life in Poems, I thought that was done really well, but it played to the youth as well as other, you know, like you said, you teach it to your students and things of that nature. So I thought if they did something like that, and he said, well, we're looking for a photographer, this type of person, that type of person. And he told me about Floyd Cooper, and I'm not in the young adult genre, so I didn't know anything about Floyd. And I told somebody, a friend of mine, Helen Frost, was in a young adult literature. I said, well, they said Floyd Cooper's going to do it. And she's like, you got Floyd Cooper? And I didn't know how big he was. And then when I saw the proofs, it just hit me because Floyd and I are around the same age and he had the same kind of experience growing up. So he said he had to change the way he put things how he laid things down. And he uses this erasing method. So it was amazing in that sense that the book became what it was. And it's basically I personify myself, and Leroy, that the poem Leroy that's a pivotal poem in the book. Mm-hmm. I had a problem with where to put that because the Gary poem has to set up everything, but Leroy is the voice.
Mm.
And so what happens is, as you notice, Leroy is pushed down more. I had the Gary poem first, and then I had Leroy second, so people could understand that Leroy, the voice was coming from Leroy. But because of the layout of the book and the pictures, we had to push Leroy down. And in making that decision, it becomes this book now about all these different aspects of boys in Gary, when it's really Leroy's perspective of everything. But since he's pushed down, now we see we get these kind of disjointed voices. But it's just Leroy's firsthand experience, reminiscing back on something, reflective experiences, and things like that. So it's basically personifying myself. And Leroy, since my middle name is Leroy, back in the day, you know how when your mother would call you in, street lights coming on, you got three tries, Curtis, Leroy, Chrysler, and, you know, you had to be in that visual sight when she, you know, when she said your whole name. And one day I actually asked her, I said, Mama, is my name Leroy or is Leroy? And she said, it's Leroy, but it's Leroy when you piss me off. And so what happened was that clicked to me. And then Leroy was the persona I could use to, you know, push the poems to and not have to worry about me and not have to worry about so much weight being on Curtis and this being identified as the I. So Leroy gives it some distance, some psychic distance away from that.
Mm. Well, this book isn't only about boys, of course,
because
now that you tell me it's from Leroy's perspective, he definitely reflects on girls in the neighborhood, sisters and mamas. Can you tell us about the women or girls in Tough Boy Sonatas?
Oh, yeah. The girls are just as tough as the boys. Sometimes at that age, a lot of them are tomboys. Even if they aren't tomboys, they play like tomboys. And so my sister, I'm the only male in my immediate family. And so I was the oldest, and I had two sisters under me, but I had two aunts older than me. So I was in a house full of women until my uncles come over, you know. And my mother, she had me at 17, so when she's 24 and I'm 7, we lose our great-great-grandmother and my mother's mother. And so she becomes the matriarch of the family. So all of a sudden, everyone's coming over our house and for Christmas, Thanksgiving, 4th of July, and all that stuff. She's the one who's keeping the family together without knowing how to do it because she has no one to go to, right? And so that becomes really relevant to me because she's... My mom, I think as William Stafford says, the voice he hears when he's writing is his mother's, and I connect to that so well because it is my mother's voice. She's always been there. So I see through her eyes sometimes, and then when I reminisce about certain aspects of that life that we got out of the project, my sisters, my aunts, they're all a part of that. And all the women that are in there, because there are women, and a lot of people think people aren't married, and some of them are, some of them aren't. It's a mishmash aspect, but the women hold together a lot of things. Because when I was coming up, we were a small family. All the people I just told you that were in my family, my little sister wasn't there when we were in the projects, but so we were a small family where at that time people were having like 7, 8, 9, 10 people in the family. And so the woman held things down big time at that point, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so so I see that we had Miss Richardson would sell candy out of her house. And there was a Miss Molly who was so French. I can't believe I even know this. Miss Molly sold French fries and pop, canned pop. And she had the best. You would sit there and wait for her to fry the fries.
Mm-hmm.
She'd give you a batch of fries. And I was wondering all these years what she put in it, but she did something with some garlic seasoning or something that she put on them before, you know, fries are like they are now. And, you know, you sit there and have a conversation with her in her kitchen, and she'd sell you fries and stuff. And back then you had the, as one of the poems addresses, the man that comes around and sells vegetables and things of that nature. You know, you have people coming around doing that. And so it was a totally different aspect growing up back then compared to, you know, how things are now. Fruit Man, the Fruit Man.
And, you know, that's one of the beautiful things about Tough Boy Sonatas, because sometimes mm-hmm. when we think about African-American neighborhoods or, you know, those neighborhoods in Gary or Chicago, where I'm from mm-hmm. Henry Horton Housing Projects in Chicago. Okay. We often think about them in uncomplicated ways as just sites of violence unwanted spaces. But there's a rich history and a rich cultural existence in those spaces as well that you rightly paint, I think, in this book. Mm-hmm. I'm hoping that you can read a selection from Tough Boy Sonatas for us, but I want to bring your attention to one that was really striking to me. Mm-hmm. It's about a female and male relationship. It's one of the more, I will call, dark poems in the book, and it's entitled Mamas, and it's on page 46 in the hardcover edition that I have. I just want to read a little bit of it to you.
Okay.
It's called Mamas, and it says, "We can't stop the male hand that strikes you. When he's gone, we are happy to see your face without imprints of love. Your hurt pulls us close to you and hugs us before you tuck us into safety." And then I'm going to skip down, and it says, "Chirping crickets never count sheep. They stay up, keep us company. And through the crack of your bedroom door, we hear your tears crash as Aretha Franklin takes you to that place women never go with men. Over and over, the music continues to skip, skip at the same spot a needle and one penny can never handle." Now, I'm going to tell you why I love this poem. I didn't read the whole thing, so listeners should be aware of that. This takes me back to playing, you know, the hi-fi with 45s and the needle skipping. I mean, it's so unlike, you know, our current CD players, et cetera. This is the experience with vinyl. And the way in which the musical legacy and tradition in African-American culture often spoke to the real lived experiences that Black people had, whatever they were, celebratory or mournful or in this sense, you know, a sort of hurtful love relationship, I think. And also the child's perspective on, or the adolescent's perspective on seeing that and being a part of it. What was the, what's behind this poem, or where do you want to convey with it?
It wasn't a personal poem. That's what's really interesting. That's why I said mamas, because this is something that you could easily see in someone else's house. Say you're playing and you go to the bathroom, and then you walk past the door, you see a little crack and you see them crying, and you know how your cousin or your friend's parents are doing, you know, that type of thing. So it was kind of like a call out for all, you know, the women that go through this. And Aretha Franklin, and growing up there was no, since we had Chicago radio stations, we were called Little Chicago, by the way, you know that. And we had Chicago radio stations. So there was no way that you didn't have music in your life. You'd go outside, music was playing on somebody's Electra 225 or Cadillac or whatever they had, or people just had it, you know, it was just playing Spanish, Bowie, Commodores, whatever it was.
Mm-hmm.
And but Aretha Franklin was Aretha Franklin, and my mother cleaned up the house to Aretha Franklin, you know. So it's just like when spring cleaning came, you know, it's just looking out on the morning rain, you know, it's like, oh, here we go, we got to clean up the house, you know. Or she'll tell us, you know, go outside where she cleaned up the house. So I wanted to connect with that aspect, especially that line. When you read it, it just did something to me. Aretha Franklin takes you to that place women never go with men.
Mm-hmm.
It seems so simple, and yet it is so profound in the sense of what they do to cope from the day-to-day of the cultural, social, economical times they're in and the things that they're going through to keep their family together, you know. So I thought that's what I was trying to, at least that's what I was trying to connect to.
Would you mind reading a selection from the book?
Yes, I will. I'm going to read Boys Love Words on page 70. And the reason I chose this one is it kind of gets me to that point of me connecting to where it all comes into play of me loving the smell of books, being in a library, being that nerdy kind of guy in one sense. So this kind of addresses that, but it also gets to the annex of what we did, you know, in that sense. Boys love words. We slogged to library to do reports on Satchmo and rustic brick red after school afternoons. Little brown faced hood rats sneaking chocolate covered donuts into library. Don't got milk or red cream soda to stop stick to roof of mouth. Half in study, laughing, hungry amongst tart, stale smell of old books, cedar chairs, dead authors, and Miss Library Lady. She looks beyond her white cat-framed glasses like we stink of piss. We too breathe the once dank lines of Whitman, the open pores of her trucking lady who makes Shakespeare sweat, and we try not to sigh when we open the hardbacks. She knows we can smell the sex, bonded and glued, sandwiched between black and white lines. No short attention span. It's our curiosity in love with the words she oversees, checks in, hands out, in love with what trickles out our mouths. We flush her cheeks, flex our callow pecs, callous Lotharios tugging at that new itch in genitalia.
Very nice. You know, one of the things about your poetry in this book and in Pulling Scabs is that you don't shy away from really revealing intimate parts of people's thoughts and natures, as a matter of fact. Mm-hmm. And I noticed a sort of a thematic, about relationships. Skipping over to Pulling Scabs, although I don't mm-hmm. want to skip there too quickly. I mean, your poem, Fornication with Ars Poetica, really stood out to me. I like the whole sort of sexual tension with words that is going on in that mm-hmm. poem. But can you want to say a word about the poem you just read?
Well, I want to say something more about what you just said in the sense of the relationship aspect. And I always thought I put that on my website that aspect of the Midwestern connection, and I'm now terming something I call urban Midwesternism or something like that is what I'm calling it. What I'm writing from. But I think all of my work addresses relationships, man relationship to man relationship to women, or to woman, to nature, our relationship to ourselves. In some aspect, we are connected to the universe in a way that we can't escape. And I was telling somebody, you think of one of the cruelest things that someone can do, and they do in jail, in prison, is put someone in solitary confinement, because in there, they have no connection to anyone.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all unless other than themselves, which is hard. And you can't even... I mean, even if you're an introvert, you can't be, usually introverts work within the confines of the collective. And now you can't even be an introvert because you can't feed off of what you're introverting from, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And in solitary confinement, you're just there with your mind and what you have. And so that can be a lot. Even if you think in the aspect of, for example, if you're a bully, well, if you're in solitary confinement, you can't bully no one.
Mm-hmm.
There's no one to bully, so the collective is gone. So you still need the collective to be around to be even the most ardent of criminals or whatever it is that you do. But as far as love and, all of that, I think is a mixture. So my aspect of relationships tend to be that I think that's the core of everything where I write from.
Very nice. Okay, so let's go to Pulling Scabs. Okay. I'm thrilled that we had an opportunity to talk about Tough Boy Sonatas. I've been eager for years to finally meet you and have an in-depth conversation about this book. And I hope that we still can in the future. Tell us how you came to write Pulling Scabs.
Now, Pulling Scabs came for me after my first workshop. The first year I went to Kavi Kainam, and I came back and I had this idea of, and the book was actually called Triplet, and it was like try, plat, plat, plat. And I had this idea of three poems, a thematic run of this aspect of these poems that were in threes, and they played off of each other. And when I was, some of the poems were getting picked up and some weren't, and it was just, it molded itself in the years after that to becoming what it is now. And so I had to, one day I just had to kind of get away, you know, because you're too close to the forest for the trees. But when I came back, I just started dismantling and reconstructing. And so after that, it was, I had another name for it, the magenta or something with magenta in it. And that didn't work. And it's hard for me to come up with a title, because titles say something, do something, and move you to look into the book in a sense. But then when Pulling Scabs came, it just, the aspect of the magenta I had, you'll see residues of it if you look in the title. And it was like a blue and magenta, and spill was part of that. And so what it was, I had like a glaze of magenta, I think it was. And so in thinking about magenta, it took me to blood. And then I just thought about the aspect of the healing, and Pulling Scabs came out of that. And I thought about how when you are little, you always want to see under the scab so you pull it. And so you have this aspect of the darkness of our history at the beginning. Then you have the middle part addressing music that kind of helps you to make it through that. And then the end is hopefully some aspect of mending, some aspect of coming together. And that's what the book, for me, does. That's how I created it. And so it's addressing that history, then dealing with that history through musical means like my funk education. And there are three poems. There's a Michael Jackson, Prince, and Madonna poem in there that are all persona poems. And it's from their perspective. So personally, ordinarily, and there's another one I can't think of right. Actually, are those. And the reason I wrote them, because they were all born in 58. Which was something interesting to me. It's like, how did these three people become so big, you know? And then I realized they were all born in 58, so it was really interesting.
Wow.
So that's what Pulling Scabs is about for me.
And Pulling Scabs reflects African-American culture and seems to be inspired by African-American culture through and through, beginning with the dedication to Ossie Davis, the actor, Rosa Parks, the civil rights activist, and Coretta Scott King. And you say that because of them, we are all the more beautiful. Why those three?
Well, they had passed that. It was like, you know, how they always say things happen in threes. And I can't remember who died last. I can't remember if it's Rosa or Coretta. I think it was Rosa, wasn't it? I don't know if I have them in the order that they die, but they had, all three had died, and it was just where you're getting to this point where you start seeing the people that you've grown up, loving, seeing in movies, things like that, being a part of your life, and they're passing. And I think about this even just like watching, Good Times, and, you know, when Florida died, or, when people start dying, and just like, man, I grew up with that person, or Weezy died on the Jeffersons. And these are the people that you just had a connection to, because these are the emulators of Black life coming up. And so when people just start dying, and it's just kind of like, wow. And when these three died, that was, they're all connected to civil rights as well as the arts and other things. And so I didn't really pay attention to that when I was thinking about it. I just thought, wow, we just lost three influential people in the Black community.
So if I tell you what my favorite poem is in this book, will you tell me what yours is?
I can try to tell you. I think it's kind of like on any given day, it may be a different one. But what's your favorite?
Okay. You know what? That might be true for me, too. Today, my favorite poem, and correct me if I mispronounced the title, it's Simonin.
Oh, Simonin, yeah. That's what I call it, yeah.
I love Simonin. That opening line, listening to Nina Simone, makes me hungry, horny for love, playful for the touch of a woman, bending my insides like a slinky. That's pretty deep. Tell us about the Nina Simone influence.
Well, I've listened to Nina Simone for a while, but it's after Carolyn Beard Whitlow, and I think it was the first year I was at Cobby, yeah, and this comes out of that. So this is one of the poems that was I had these poems, as you can see, it's kind of from one side to the next, but there's this, I call it my newspaper poem, because it has that newspaper feel to it, where there's all this white space in between lines and letters and things of that nature. But she has a poem called, I don't know the title of it, but in the poem she's saying, Nina, she moans, Nina, she moans. And she had that poem going, and we were all on the edge of our seat. And I look over to my right, and a gentleman who's usually, you know, collective, has, you know, pretty much, you know, he's pretty, not, I won't say stoic, but he keeps himself together. Yusef Komunyakaa's on the edge of his seat, just looking at it. It's kind of like she's playing jazz, and he's just like, oh, no, she didn't, kind of, you know, that's the feel I'm getting. I'm like, where am I at? And what I call what she did Simonin. And so that's where that comes from. And then I just took that, and it's like, well, how do I do something to address what she just did to us, you know.
Wow. So what are you feeling today in terms of the poems and pulling scabs?
Well, I had that as one of the poems. I had that and before the reshowing of Megar Evers, his son, says Salon. So I'll hit Simonin, if that's fine.
Very nice.
Okay. Yeah. Simonin. Listening to Nina Simone makes me hungry, horny for love, playful for the touch of woman, bending my insides like a slinky. It's idiotic how her voice tracks on scale, a roller coaster glossing permanent trajectory about how black her lover's hair stands. The river in her tones transmute into puddles of glory, grace God gives to Abraham, Moses, and David. When no one recalls Hagar or Sarah, Zipporah or Bathsheba, Nina moans. She conjures their essence with the little spittle she has left, something like Jesus in her passion. Federico Garcia Lorca must confess she is duende abound. She isn't pomp, don't play Eucharist. Nina has apt appetite and greedily eats the fabric of consciousness, like meditating yogi. It is Muga for her. Open up the heart and let mouth Ellington all arrangements. And when note flutters inside gut, make it chime every groin like a metronome.
Very nice. Beautiful. Could you tell us about the poet's voice? And not the voice in the writing, but it's something about the way you poets read that is really delightful. Tell us about that performance.
I always tell my students, poetry works on three ways. You can write it, you can hear it, and you can say it. And so the aspect of, like a lot of people get away from the aspect of performance, because you can be, there's a hyperbolicness to that, you know, to overdoing it, you know. And so when you see slams, you can see some people going overboard in a sense. But if you really want them to hear your words, you need to say the words as they need to be said. And you have to think about this musically in the sense of tempo. If we're going to talk about meter and metrics and all that kind of stuff, you're writing that. But I feel like a jazz player when I'm reading, just like I said, on any given day, it could be any given poem. I feel like the tone or the timbre of the poem can change on the aspect of my mood or emotion. So when I'm reading, I just connect, you know, I always think these are the words that you put together. Let them hear your words. And so when I'm reading, I look to that. Some people are good readers. Some people aren't good readers. Some people are good performers. Some people aren't good performers. And some people are good readers and performers. So they know how to play between the tone, the register, all that stuff. And it's kind of like the only way I can think of it is the first time we saw Michael Jackson, Motown 25th anniversary, and his brothers leave the stage, and Billie Jean comes on, mm-hmm. and he's up there, and everybody's looking at him. Nobody else is up there. Everybody's looking at him. You don't know what your mama's saying. You don't know what anybody's saying. For that, the length of that song, Michael is on, and we're there. And that's what a poem should do. I told my students the other day, a poem slows you down. A poem says, hold up, you have to listen to me. You cannot not listen to me, you know. And so in reading that, you have to alliterate, articulate, and give to the aspect of that rhythm and the words that you chose to put together, I think. And so poetry, some people have a poetic tone that's kind of, they read the line and you can tell where the breaks are and stuff like that. And like I said, I feel more jazzy in a sense. It's the same song. It could be the same song every night, but as far as the timbre of it and things, that's going to change. So you get a different mood to it, maybe.
Is there a consistent influence among poets, do you think, from Archibald MacLeish's Ars Poetica?
Mm-hmm.
The reason I ask that is because in a previous interview that I did with another poet, he has a poem called Ars Poetica, and so do you. So, what's that influence?
Well, I think what I had never written an Ars Poetica poem, and so the aspect to write about the, you know, to write on poetry, the meta discursiveness of that was really interesting to me. And then it's like, well, how can I write one that no one else has written, so to speak? And then I just kind of addressed it in the sense of following a beautiful girl in one sense. And then it hit me. But yeah, there's a lot of Ars Poetica poems. And I think people, you kind of want to stretch stretch your range, so to speak. So you can show that, yeah, I can do an Ars Poetica poem. I can do a sonnet. I can do a sestina. You know, bring it on. I can do a bot, you know, whatever it is. And so for me, that's what it was. But there, yeah, I think you're going to see, I don't know of a poet that doesn't do them,
mm-hmm,
you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's just to try it, to play with the language of the poetic, the theory behind poetry and things of that nature.
Very nice. So the other poem that you mentioned that you're going to read, mm-hmm. I'm going to ask you to read that right at the end of our interview so that we can have your voice as the last thing. But I want to ask you, what are you working on now?
I'm working on three manuscripts, two of poetry, one of fiction. The first one is called Spilt Lip, and It gives to, Spilt Lip is a tag for a person who's, you know, kind of like tagging the city and things of that nature. Basquiat used to do back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I'm doing is, you know, it's kind of like I started out, I had it as something else, and then, Terrence Hayes messed me up because he came out with Lighthead, And I had something like match head or something like that. And I was like, oh, I can't do match head now, you know, because he has light head. And so so I had to switch it up to something else. And spilt lip kind of gave to the aspect of a tagger's name versus the spilling of words coming out of the mouth, so to speak. And so he's the one who's writing through the poems, and you're seeing I'm splashing his name on like random pages here and there, like spilt lip was here, or you know, by the end is like spilt lip is not here anymore, or spilt lip is no more playing off the Basquiat, you know, same old is dead, so to speak. And so so you get that play through there, and most of his poems are addressing urban life, urban connections to what's going on. There's a poem I have. It was a DJ poem at first, of DJ 2010, and then I gave it to Spilt Lip, and he became the voice of it. And it's him talking to the president. It says our first black president is called racist when the body he comes from, the womb, the life of his womb is white. And, you know, it gets to this facial thing that we see. We see him as a black man, but we don't see his mother, his grandmother, that side of his family. And it was a white commentator who said Obama is, you know, a racist against white. So Spilt Lip is going in and saying, you know, dude, don't ever, you know, we're from the Midwest I come from. We, you know, we close eyes, you know, with fists and stuff like that. And so he, so this is going through all this turmoil of what has been happening in the last couple of years and things of that nature. And it's very relevant to now, because everybody's trying to find a footing, trying to understand who they are, trying to get a job, all that kind of stuff. And I remember in the 80s, I was on the other side of that. Now I'm on the side that, you know, trying to maintain the job. Mm-hmm. Where in the 80s, I was, you know, with Reaganomics and things of that nature, I couldn't even get a job at McDonald's, you know. So it's really interesting and relevant. So I think Spilt Lip addresses that. And then the other book is, I'm actually calling it 45s and 33s. And and it's
I like that, by the way. I like that title.
Thanks. Well, the first half is about Stevie Wonder, and I was thinking about how Stevie Wonder has been the soundtrack to my life. And one day after, like I was telling you before about so many people passing and stuff, and I thought, man, what if Stevie Wonder died? You know, and I thought about it. There has not been a day I've not known Stevie Wonder's singing in my house or whatever, you know, in my life. And then the next week, Michael Jackson died. And so I was like, really, it really hit me, because Michael Jackson had been, you know, being from Gary, you know, it's almost like you're from Gary, you have to dance like the Jacksons or something, you know. So that first poem addresses the narrator saying, thinking about you passing, I killed Michael Jackson, in a sense. And it goes through, and it addresses Stevie's life. And then the second part, 33s, is about, not Sylvester, you know the song? And Mama used to say,
mm-hmm.
Take your time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it's based on that. And so you had the song broken up, opening up little fissures, and it'll be like, and Mama used to say, and then it'll be what my mother really said. And there's these like prose-like lines that give to something like I can't think of her name like that right now, but she did Sperm Kit, and Harriet Mullins kind of gives to some of the stuff I read when I was reading Harriet Mullins. So it's working on those two artists, again addressing the aspect of music in my life. I think I in looking at my work, you see music is a big part of everything, I guess.
And what about this latest book that's out, the young adult novel, Dreamist?
Okay, and it's funny that you're from Chicago, because it's about it. What happens is, I'll give you a little synopsis. Malik gets a scholarship to go to Cal State. but you have to go the summer of your junior year to get inundated and participate in the scholarship. So when he's there, he's unpacking his stuff, and he's in his room, and he finds a photo album, which he didn't pack. So he knows his mother and father snuck it in there. And when he's going through the photo album, he's looking back and seeing all the people, his family, his friends in Chicago and everything. And, you know, he's getting very nostalgic in a sense. So he writes these poems to the pictures that he's seen in the photo album. So you get the poems from that perspective, but then you get the narrative of what's happening to him as this is going on. So you have the prose and the poetry put together to make a novel.
Very nice. And so we've taken up a lot of your time. You've enlightened us greatly on your poetry and on the projects that you're working on now. Can you take us out with one of your poems?
Yes. I want to read this because of the last word that addresses resurrection. And well, I'll read this before. I'll just read the note so they can get people background who may not know. Before the reshowing of Medgar Evers, His Son Sits Alone was inspired by the resuming of the slain civil rights leader Medgar Evers, who was shot in front of his home in Jackson, Mississippi on June 12, 1963. Byron Dela Beckwith was finally convicted in 1994 after the resuming. Evers' body was so pristine, even 30 years later, his family had an open casket showing, reminiscent of Mamie Till for Emmett Till.
Mm, very nice. Thank you so much, Curtis Chrysler.
Oh, thank you.
And we hope to have you back on the show again.
Okay.
To learn more about Curtis L. Chrysler, please visit his website at www.poetboyworks.com. That's www.poetboyworks.com. We were delighted to have Chrysler on the show today and look forward to talking to him about his young adult novel, Dreamist, that was published in August 2011. Please visit his website and listen in again.